Hello and welcome the internet. This is Advice.
To the players.
To the players. I am your host, as always, Jonathan Redding, and with me, coming to you from the beautiful Antaeus Theatre Company space in North Hollywood, with me, as always, is...
I'm Philip Kelly. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm okay, how are you?
I'm doing all right. It's been a little while.
This month? It's been a while.
Yeah, we haven't sat down for maybe 6 weeks, 8 weeks.
I know.
Yeah.
What did they think of us now?
I don't know. And now we're sitting here pretending that Rob Nagel of Antaeus and Jessica Kobzanski, who directed Macbeth and Antaeus and is also artistic director of Boston Court, and Rob is one of the artistic directors of Antaeus, are sitting right here. Guys, thank you so much for taking out the time to talk with us and come on the show.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
And thank you for including us in your reunion after 6 weeks. That's an honor to be in the room with you.
I know. It's our comeback. Thank you. This is our comeback episode. Where did they go? They've lost it. They're gone forever. No, we're back with.
We're back with wonderful artists.
Yes. Welcome to Antaeus, and thank you for coming over from Boston Court, Jessica.
Oh, sure.
The theater at...
My pleasure.
Mm-hmm. We had an opportunity to come out last weekend and see one of the casts of Macbeth, and we both thought that it was a wonderful production and enjoyed it very much. The sensibilities behind it, the choices that you made, the performances. I understand, and just from reading and Googling, that you had quite a positive reaction, critically and in terms of your audience.
We did all right with the idea that we were trying to put out there.
Yeah.
I say we very loosely.
No, but, without question.
We definitely derived it together, I think.
Yes.
The first thing I'd love to ask you is if you could talk a little bit about your workshop process. How Antaeus chooses plays, how you developed this particular idea, and how it grew into the production that we saw.
Sure. Well, that is an always moving line, because we're still figuring it out here as to how it works. Only in the last several years have we been producing with regularity, and a lot of that, the company's been around for 20, it's going on 21 years. Since Gordon Davidson, I've been told, this was way before I was born, Gordon Davidson had wanted to find a group of actors in Los Angeles for doing classical works, and so all of a sudden, Monday nights, a group of people formed down at the Taper Annex, and every Monday night they'd do process work. They'd read plays, or they'd do a study cycle on a history play. They'd do Henry VI, Part 1, and they'd do a study cycle for 6 months, or they'd do mask work, or they'd do commedia. They'd do whatever interested them, whatever geeky, nerdy, classical theater things they'd do. But then it took years and years before we started producing with any regularity. And Jeannie Hackett helped lead that charge as artistic director and got us producing. Then somehow I fell into the fold some years after they started producing, and tried to figure out how they did things. They seemed to do things by starting with readings and starting with explorations. And so at a certain point last year, I think it was January of 2011, I thought, you know what I want to do? I want to revisit this play called Macbeth. I tried it in college when I was 20, the definitive Macbeth at the age of 20, I gotta tell you, it was amazing. Anyway, it was a struggle. It was a struggle to revisit it and bring it back, but I just said I wanted to read it around the table, so we read it around the table. And that became kind of a joyful experience for me and for the company. Everyone got very excited about doing this play again, since I think they probably explored it in the past. So we sat down, and Jessica, bless her heart, attended and sat in and listened, and we found ourselves moving forward to a...
So you brought it into a... started putting it up on its feet into a staged version.
After we did we did that in January, I think we revisited it again. No, I think I initiated it in January. The reading must have been sometime around June.
It was in May,
May or June.
Yeah.
And then once we got around to Classics Fest last year, there was some interest in bringing it back, and at that point, Jessica had been paired up with me to try to bring it to some kind of life over the course of four different stage reading nights, and that's what we did in August, I think, of last year. No?
The workshop?
Yeah, when did we workshop it?
It was sometime in August. I know for me, I had a conversation with somebody mentioned to me, someone at Antaeus mentioned to me that Rob Nagel had initiated the idea of doing Macbeth, and I had been passionately interested in working with Rob for years, and I love Macbeth. And so I expressed some interest, and Rob and I got together and had a conversation about what was important to both of us about the story, and found ourselves in great agreement, at which point we decided to go forward. I am a Shakespeare freak, and I was actually supposed to be directing Romeo and Juliet last summer at the now-defunct Theater 150. They were running out of money, so Romeo and Juliet turned into a... two-character play called Breadcrumbs, a really really beautiful new play by Jen Haley called Breadcrumbs, which was lovely but did not satisfy my Shakespeare Jones. So this sort of all happened simultaneously. The idea that Antaeus was interested in exploring Macbeth, and I was suddenly deprived of my ability to do Shakespeare that summer. And so I said, oh my God, well, I would love to work with Rob, and I would love to investigate Macbeth with the company. So, you know, from my perspective, that's how it was born. But we did have this incredibly crucial first conversation about sort of, I mean, to me, the thing that's brilliant about Shakespeare is that there are so many stories to be told inside each of his plays, because he is just so rich and deep and full of breadth. And so it was pretty important to me that we wanted to tell at least a similar story.
I was watching a Charlie Rose recently, and I heard Shakespeare referred to as that great 17th century psychoanalyst.
I cannot but agree. So that was the thing that really, actually, when we had that first conversation and sort of talked about what the story might be.
In those first conversations, what was the story? What angle did you guys settle on?
I think you made me go first.
I can't remember,
but I think you did. I think you said, so what's in the play for you? That's what I remember. That's my revisionist history.
Awesome.
So what is it for you? And I said something in my revisionist history. I believe I said, I'm not interested in a bad guy. I'm not interested in a horror story. I'm interested in finding that Shakespearean tragedy that is in this play that is so often glossed over, that we lose him and her so early on. Every time you see the show, you're just waiting for them to kill themselves or die. And I was interested in seeing good people make some horrible, horrible decisions rather than bad people doing bad things. The other thing that always had interested me was that famous line, "I have given suck and know how tender 'tis to love the babe that milks me." I never understood that in productions that I'd see, because no one seemed to make any sense of it to me. It was glossed over, and it's such a huge thing to say, to pluck his nipple from my boneless gum and dash the brains out, that I so sworn as you have done to this. They just skipped over it. And I always thought it was such a beautiful turn of phrase of, what if there was something there between them? What if there was a child?
And I had said to Rob, well, interestingly, the thing that's interesting to me is I think the Macbeths have just lost a child, and that I'm very interested in seeing what happens if good people who are half out of their minds with grief end up choosing to do a bad thing because they're grief-struck and desperately in need of another project. And it seemed pretty clear that we were very much on the same page about what the story was that we were interested in telling. And there were lots more details than that, but I mean, that was the essence of the conversation.
Right. And, no, go ahead.
I had an opportunity to direct it in 2009 at the Los Angeles Theater Ensemble in Santa Monica, and old friend of mine, college buddy that I directed as the Scottish King, and you know, with mixed results in terms of what we were able to manifest, and this is a tremendous learning experience. But I recall our first conversation, sitting down and saying, you know, well, what is it? You know, what is this thing that we're looking at? And you know, Ian McKellen had that famous sort of declaration of like, well, it's a horror show, And we agreed that we thought it was a love story.
Mm-hmm. We think that too.
Another thing that we'd said at that table. It's a love story. Mm-hmm. I did say that. I'm not making this up.
No,
you're absolutely right.
I believe you, because I saw it in your production. I saw things where I was like, oh, that was a great idea. I wish I had thought of that.
Well,
my dearest partner of greatness, he says to her And there is such a partnership between them. It's such a beautiful relationship, actually.
Yeah.
Which is part of why when they go down, they both go down, you know?
In a horrible, terrible way together.
And to see them drawn away from each other by the action of the play.
And to see him devastated when she, you know, dies.
Yes.
That devastation. So I've seen productions where he isn't. He's just like, oh.
Existential dilemma here.
Yeah, exactly.
Everything is signifying nothing.
Yeah.
What was the crux of that is the queen, my lord, is dead. Mm-hmm. If you don't have that love story, I'm not interested in telling the story. I mean, there are many versions of this story that I'd love to be a part of, but if you can't find tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow out of her, then I don't think you have a play that's of great interest to the human heart. When we did the Classics Fest staged version of it in the fall, and Tias kind of got a taste of Jessica's take on the show, and everyone was really excited at the company. That's how it kind of grew into the season. I certainly was an advocate of it because I thought it was a brilliant take on this show that I don't usually see. And a lot of the audiences that came to see it said the same thing. We did surveys around the company and surveys of the audiences, and people got coming back to, what about Macbeth? What about Macbeth? Mm-hmm. So it rose kind of like, you know, cream should rise, I think, out of our projects. And that's kind of how we try to find projects here. We also try to attach really amazing people like Jessica onto productions like this.
Well, I love that you give yourselves that kind of time frame and permission and thoughtfulness to the productions that you choose or that choose you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that care and that attention to detail really shows in the final product of what you bring to bear on the stage and the art that you make.
Well, thank you.
Well, directorially, I will say it was a real luxury too, because there are things that choices I made in the workshop that I really expanded in the full production.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about rumination time in between events. You know, in the workshop, the play opened with Lady M just sort of, there was a little baby carriage and she put a flower on the grave of her child. And that was essentially the nod to what became in the full production, seeing the Macbeths go through the funeral of their child.
So I want to just take a moment to frame this before we really get into the meat of it, because you guys approached it with what I think of as the causal approach to Macbeth, you know, and there are different ways that people go about it.
Yeah.
You see it done in a way that's meant to be sort of shock and awe and that's terrifying. You see it done in a way that's like pseudo-Faustian, that's very much a morality tale. And you see it done as an examination of evil. It's difficult for people, I think, because as Shakespeare progressed in his career and in his craft, he became less and less interested in explicating his characters for us. You know, for example, we get Iago, who provides a plethora of reasons why he might or might not be doing what he's doing, but we never get a satisfactory answer.
Right.
And Macbeth, similarly, the only words that are untainted that we get to hear from him in the whole play is, "So fair and foul a day I have not seen," you know, before the witches are there to plant the seed. And so we don't get to see what I think is inferred as a relationship that was beautiful, you know, before it begins to be tainted by this thing. And you guys really chose that more method approach of looking at, you know, but looking backwards into the full breadth of these people's lives, and that permeated the whole show. And I think that's spectacular.
Yeah, really,
I loved that.
It really brought like some freshness to things that I've seen many times, just in moments between characters. Really brought to life that tragic, that connection.
And Macbeth is a play. You know, it's written approximately 1605, to the best of our ability to judge, and it's thought of usually as being the capstone piece following King Lear at the head of those four great tragedies. And then sometimes people include Antony and Cleopatra as kind of a sunset on that high tragic period. But like Lear, there's something apocalyptic about the play. You know, there's such a destruction of the world, and similarly at the end of it, you have this, you know, boy king, essentially, who is left in this haunted, war-blasted landscape to try to rebuild.
In some ways, the rise of England you know, out of Scotland, mirroring James's ascension. It's a very interesting, you know, Scottish, and let's not even get into the Catholicism, the Protestantism that was going on at the time, and the gunpowder plot and all, but it's a very interesting patriotic for England and for Scotland play, it seems to me.
You might know this. I actually don't.
I probably don't, but go ahead, ask.
In Lear, you know, we're left at the end with Edgar and sort of king by default. Like, everybody else kind of steps away and is like, I don't want any part of this. He historically is credited with being the king that rid the Isle of England of wolves, which I love. And I'm wondering if Malcolm's reign is, no, if you came across that at any point, because I've never thought to look into that. Like, I wonder who Malcolm was.
Well, I mean, there's no question he was officially an antecedent of King James. Mm-hmm. That's what, you know, this is the Scottish play is, there's a theory that this was commissioned by King James, right? And so there, and among other things, King James had a bug up his butt about witches. But because it's very interesting in the Holinshed, which is the historical backstory for
the chronicle.
A lot of this. Yeah, exactly. You know, the witches are referred to as nymphs or goddesses. And by the time Shakespeare writes them, he describes, well, certainly Macbeth describes them as secret black and midnight hags. That's a very interesting evolution, but there's no question that King James wrote a lot of treatise on the perfidy of witches. So there's a lot that was probably influenced by the king he was writing for. And that's why Malcolm is the beginning of a line of, you know, Banquo. The fact that Banquo is actually going to be the line of kings that becomes King James. I don't know, in terms of Malcolm, what his specific references.
So if a listener knows,
shoot
us an email at advice@gmail.com.
There's a lot of, if you go historically and talk about these characters, they weren't characters, they were people. I mean, Macbeth was quite a great king. He ruled for 13 or 17 years. Mm-hmm. I can't recall which. He was on his first marriage with Lady Macbeth. Lady Macbeth was on her second. Her previous husband apparently was burned alive with 50 of his soldiers, you know, Scotland, with 50 of his soldiers by either Macbeth or Duncan. We're not sure. There's so much information about the history that it doesn't really inform the play, because, of course, this is based on historical events, but Shakespeare had some other things in mind to explore. But, Malcolm was not as long, as I recall, was not as long lived on the throne as Macbeth was, or as his father Duncan was. James was not, he was, I'm sure, happy to see Banquo not be caught in the murder of Duncan, because some information tells us that Macbeth and Banquo did it together. We don't know. Sorry, guys. Don't mean to damn you to history this way. We don't know how it ended, but we know that James was probably very happy to see his line rising out, and certainly
each
the witches.
Each handsomer than the last.
Just beautiful. All the lines of them, all the way down to him, how beautiful, even when you inbreed, how beautiful the kings become. I liked also reading up about, there was some evidence that James had banned the production after he saw the first one, because the witches so freaked him out. So for a first, a year or two, I think. I don't know if it's true or not, but there's some evidence that leads them to suggest that, he maybe didn't like those witches so much, he wouldn't let it be seen for a while.
Well, I like what you guys did with the witches in this, and maybe it's informed by the kind of more grounded approach, human approach, but they seemed very, like, real people in the beginning, as opposed to witches that were cackling and dancing about the stage.
The least interesting choice for me was actually to see them be sort of women around going with carbuncles and boils, and I'm much more interested in them being old women who had lived on the planet for a while and know things. And it's not that they don't. I think the membrane between nature, the signs and I mean, nature is such a huge thing in this play, as anyone who knows the play will tell you. Nature goes awry as soon as acts of evil are perpetrated in the world, and there's this really powerful connection between the actions of the people and the effects it has on the natural world.
Yes.
And
in some of the other plays as well, in Caesar.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Duncan's horses eat each other, and knights, you know, it, by the clock 'tis day, you know, but it, but it looks dark. I mean, there is so much about nature, which is actually a lot of what informed the set design for this production.
Beautiful, beautiful blood set. On the top of the tree.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tom Butterwitz.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. It's so subtle. And I was like, oh, there's blood up there.
The gradation of color coming up from the floor into the red at the top.
Yeah, and it
was great. But I mean, really, the play was so much for me, at least, about parents and children, actually, because there is so much in the play about parents and children, about nature and the effects of actions of the humans on the planet, and you know, family tree, you know, so between nature and the family tree, that's really what informed the set design that Tom Butterwitz made, which is really an incredibly beautiful thing.
It's fun to play on it too.
It's a yummy set. I actually love it. But in terms of the witches, I was extremely interested in them being women that we could know, that they were not you wouldn't walk down the street and go, oh my god, a witch, you know. I think what's so interesting is, it's so interesting because it's very clear how Macbeth is affected, but if you carefully listen to Banquo in the course of the play, ever since both of them met the witches, neither of them have been able to sleep.
Yes.
There is something about Banquo says, a heavy summons lies like lead upon me, and yet I would not sleep. And he says, merciful heaven, you know, restraining me the cursed thoughts that nature gives way to in repose.
Well done. Look, we can do the whole show.
I know. but it is that. It's a very interesting idea about people predicting things that may already be in your mind, and whether or not that is a self-fulfilling prophecy, or if they are simply plucking out something they sense in you already. I was just very interested in not the witches as these causal creatures of evil, but actually as women who observe. They've been on the planet for a while, and they know human beings. And they see into them possibly more deeply than other people, and they see what's going on. And I was extraordinarily interested in them simply being women who have been around for a while and know things.
Yeah. And I think I've told you this before. I wasn't quite clear on what these witches were going to be in Jessica's concept of them, and I didn't necessarily think I bought it either. And I thought, like, don't they have to be some kind of perpetrating some kind of evil? Don't they have to be involved? And like, no, they see things, and they're both blessed and cursed by that. And I, for the longest time, I was still not quite sure. And then we had auditions for the show, and had members of the company and some guests from the company. And when there were two of the women, I'll never tell you who they were, because otherwise they'll all be asking me, all six of my witches, or all seven of my witches. The two of the women came in and auditioned, and they left the room, and I grabbed Jessica and said, I understand. I get it now.
That's wonderful.
They just did something that I totally understand the concept.
Yeah.
And before I've been, show me.
Yeah.
Show me.
You permitted your witches to make fart jokes.
I encouraged it, in fact.
They were not the same, like, so many, I see the show and it's the same damn sexy witches every time. Mm-hmm. Like, I see a lot of like movement specific and fluid. It's there are a lot of traps.
Believe me. Sirens have their place in the Weird Sisters. I've seen some amazing productions where they do.
So I, and possibly because of that.
Yeah.
I actually wanted, this is what I've been interested in about this play for such a long time. I'm more interested in them as real human beings, because I actually think that's more terrifying. Mm-hmm. A real human being who tells you something profound about yourself is terrifying. It's much more terrifying than if you can write it off as a boogeyman, you know? And so, where hast thou been, sister, killing swine, and she's offering her bacon? I think these are women with a sense of humor, you know? And people know they're witches, a rointhy witch, and they're offended by being called witches, you know? But in a playful way, because I was just extraordinarily interested in the humanity of all the people in the play. I think it really kind of comes down to that.
You had them at the banquet scene, if I remember correctly.
I did.
Which was interesting, because I haven't seen that before. What was your thought behind that? I'm curious.
You know, my thought was, I did, you know, there are a couple things I did with the witches that, I'm sure there's great debate about whether or not this is a good or bad choice. You know, I moved Hecate's speech to the top of the play.
Yes. Yeah. One of the very few textual changes you made. You cut very little, anything.
I cut a couple things, but very few things. Mostly because I revere this text. I think it's brilliant. The show's not that long.
But you took Hecate and put her up front.
I did. I put Hecate up front because I wanted it to be an issued challenge to the witches. I actually wanted her to... I mean, for me, it's almost like the prologue in Romeo and Juliet. Two households, both alike in dignity, and fair Verona, where we lay our scene. And Hecate sort of sees... There's this... I mean, this actually is connected to things that actors found that were all connected to me in the moment of the funeral, which starts before the play. Macbeth, the weeping Lady Macbeth, is led away from Macbeth, leaving him alone on stage. And Rob did this, and Beau actually both, do this really incredible thing, but I think this is something Rob found early on, where he started to cross himself and stopped. And for me, that was the moment where the crack in his heart opened in this moment of complete bitterness, unbearable grief, how God could have forsaken him, all of those things. And in that moment, that's when I decided to have Hecate start speaking and sort of say, you know, see into him in a way and sort of envision a possible future for what might go down. And it sort of, and it hasn't happened to him yet, I don't think. It's just that the crack opened. You know, Stoppard has that great line, fear the crack that might flood your brain with light. And in a weird way, this cracking open of his heart in unbearable grief, to me, is the thing that started to let in those thoughts that, in a better state, Macbeth would never give way to, I think.
Yeah.
You know, so that it was all connected, but I thought it would be really interesting to make it a challenge that Hecate is envisioning. And then this sort of follows into why I had the witches at the banquet. I don't think they know all things. I think that they set into motion, she says, do you dare to trade and traffic with Macbeth and riddles and affairs of death? She challenges them, and they dare to take it on. In my mind, the witches, there are projects the witches take on that are about good as well. Hmm. They're not necessarily purely about evil. They are women who sort of take on things that are of profound nature. So they go to the banquet because they set this terrible thing in motion. And when Banquo is killed, they feel like they have to see what happens next. So they choose to disguise themselves and go to the banquet.
Interesting.
I want the audience to know that there were the witches. I don't want Macbeth to know, although I'm perfectly fine if some people were like, maybe Macbeth is seeing them, or maybe they're a figment of his mind, or maybe, you know, I was okay with the ambiguity. But it felt to me like I thought they should see what happened next, because I don't think they knew that, I mean, thou shalt get kings, but though thou be none, they clearly knew that Banquo was not going to survive. I don't know if they knew how that happened, or if they watched that happen and sort of like, oh, fuck. You know, I gotta see what happens next, you know.
It's interesting, the whole conundrum of, you know, they're planting the notion, and sort of what you know, in Buddhism would be called the dependent arising phenomena, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's dependent upon that future, you know, requires the observer, and it requires its component parts to come into being behind it. And if it had not been suggested, if it had not been in this backhanded way sort of prophesied.
Right.
You know, but also the idea that to any human being, it's very unsettling when you make Macbeth perhaps not an ordinary man, but a man with good parts, you know, a man with valor and compassion and love in him.
Yeah.
And also terrible grief and terrible wounding.
Yeah.
And the implication being like, well, what if somebody said to me, you know, this is going to happen and then this is going to happen and then you'll have this opportunity. Like, what thought might arise to me? I guess that...
It's almost like the anti-Job. We're not going to take everything from you. Instead, we're going to offer you everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See what you do with it.
Nice, nice.
I like that.
Yeah.
It's really, really cool.
Well, and the text, you know, I feel like nothing that... I did was laid on the text as some weird idea. It feels to me like it was purely what the text was supporting mm-hmm. and asking for in some ways, because, you know, I feel thy letters have transported me beyond the ignorant present, you know, and I feel now the future in the instant. And he says, puts in my, you know, in my grip, they have put, Rob, you'll have to say this because I'm going to butcher it, an unlineal...
Oh, yes.
Yeah. A barren
upon
scepter.
Upon my head they placed a fruitless crown, put a barren scepter in my grip, thence to be wrenched with an unlineal hand, no son of mine succeeding.
Yeah. So, to me, there was just so much in the text about the ignorant present, I feel now, the future in the instant, the need, the idea that maybe they're not going to have another child, much as they would like to, that... if they're going to become king, maybe this is their only opportunity, you know? I mean, it's interesting because Macbeth makes great arguments. I have won golden opinions, which would yes. be worn now in their newest gloss, not cast aside so soon. Mm-hmm. But, and yet, the urgent, insane need I think they have, which is partially because they're still incredibly grieving, you know, is to me was such a powerful motivator.
Speaking to the... you know, the theme of parents and children, this is, you can make arguments for other instances, but this is certainly the clearest and the most brutal and one of the very few instances of the murder of a child that's explicit on stage. I mean, you could talk about the age of young Arthur and King John.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the, you know, the slaying of Macduff's clan.
Yeah.
And you had the very brutal choice to have an infant suffocated by one of the murderers.
Yeah. I did.
You must have bad dreams.
I do. Tortured soul.
No, but that it was done in a way that was very difficult to watch.
Yes.
And it helped to drive that home that this, you know, childless couple had become the perpetrators of childlessness. And then, you know, it becomes so haunted when Malcolm is you know, extolling Macduff to take up his sword and go get vengeance. And he says he has no children.
Yeah. Yeah.
I saw it done once, actually, that they had, the Macbeths had a child, like, living.
Uh-huh.
And that there was, like, a preamble to the play where, you know, he was going off to the war and, you know, hugged his son goodbye. And that line was delivered as a threat. That line was like a promise, like, he has no children.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
It didn't really do it for me, but it was an interesting idea.
A for effort on that.
Yeah. Yeah, I've never seen that before.
Yeah, and Rob found this incredible thing in rehearsal, you know, where he is aware of what he's doing, even when he says it. The castle of Macduff, I will surprise, seize upon fife, right?
Give to the edge of the sword his wife, his babes, and all unfortunate souls that trace him in his line.
And you can see Macbeth understand with pain this thing he's about to do, which is such an interesting idea to me about the vestiges. I mean, the reason the Macbeths go down, this is why the people, there are people who are quite offended by the idea of making the Macbeths potentially good people who do a bad thing and what ensues, which is really fascinating as a debate.
I don't understand why that's an issue. I always figure, you know, Hamlet is always honorable. King Lear is always honorable. Othello is always honorable. Why can't Macbeth and Lady Macbeth be honorable, making similar horrible mistakes?
Macbeth has such compunction for so long about the choices he's being forced to make even as he makes them, that to me it's the most profound argument for the truth of that. You know, but there are people who I guess think he should just be evil the whole time, and I think there's no value in that, because on the theory that most of us try really hard not to be evil, then we can't relate. We can only watch him as a monster.
Yeah.
But in fact, everything that happens to him because that's what might happen to us if we were to do that thing.
Yeah.
If we were to kill the king in this moment of, you know, and then never being able to rest easy. But I thought, you know, there's a design choice that the costume designer Jessica Olson and I made that I know no one will understand.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone in the play is actually wearing what we call child tabs, Like, it's actually a badge of honor.
I was gonna ask you
they
about
have
that.
These sure. little hanging, dangling things that say how many children they have. And the Macbeths at the funeral rip off their child tags.
And bury them with the child.
Yeah, I got that when Macduff tears his.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah.
You know, and that so becomes such a pitiful exchange.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. So.
But that was a bit like, when he pulled, I was like,
Yeah, oh, cool. Thank you for understanding.
Glad you
it.
Got it.
It's a very subtle thing that I didn't expect most people to understand, but I mean, that was, you know, that was also part of it. It was, and it's why, you know, it's why it was really important to me wherever possible for people to cherish their children, because children were something precious in this society, and the fact that the Macbeths, that's the one thing they couldn't have, you know.
Well, when the character, and I can't recall his name, at the end says he died honorably when he finds out his son died.
Seward.
Yeah. Nice moment. I mean, that kind of falls mm-hmm. right
yeah,
behind,
that often gets that often gets excised.
Yeah.
Well, I think that he was his eulogizing his son, you know, and giving that its full weight and its full gravity and continuing that this is affecting down the line, you know, giving some scope to the war.
Yeah.
I was thinking what we were talking about, the, you know, honor, and some people have a real strong allergic reaction to making Macbeth and Lady Macbeth human in any way. We'd rather make people into monsters. We'd rather transform our perception of evil acts into monsters. We'd rather look at Al-Qaeda, and we'd rather look at the terrorists who were in the planes on 9/11 as monsters, rather than look at them as people who had parents and who might have had children, who believed they were doing right. Yes, monstrous act, but we want to lump together the monstrous act with the person, and I'm an actor. I'm much more interested in trying to figure out people.
Well, and the cool thing about that, in exploring it in this sort of way, is when just a normal person comes up and watches the show, they see that in the world around them. Like, an actor can be told, you're great, you're going to make it. And then, like, yeah, and they're going to do everything maybe that they can to make it. Like, you know, the first thing I call is Rosemary's Baby, where he has the other actor killed, like, to do this thing, to pass out, you know, if you've seen Rosemary's Baby. Mm-hmm. And that's a horrible act by somebody who's a normal human being. Mm-hmm. And it relates on every level to every human to some degree. Maybe they haven't killed somebody.
Yeah, what if you did one terrible thing in the dead of night and you woke up tomorrow in a world where all of your dreams had come true?
Yeah.
But then the crux that you wake up in that world, and suddenly what do you have to do to keep it? You know, the fundamental human fear, I will not get what I want, I will lose what I have.
Yeah. Well, it's actually why I kept Hecate's speech, because she says, you all know security is mortal's chiefest enemy.
Yes.
You know, to be thus is nothing, but to be safely thus.
Yes. And there's none but Banquo, whose being I do fear.
Yeah.
Under him my genius is rebuked. And the safety, the issue is safety that even Macbeth talks about with regard to Banquo before his killing.
And again with Macduff.
Yeah.
It's
this idea that once he's done this thing, he can never be secure. So we have scorched the snake, not killed it. You know, that there's never a time where I can rest.
Sleep no more.
Yeah.
It's so interesting to me. And I want to talk about that fatigue, because that was something I felt in the performance. It's often missing. And I love that. I think it's so important, sleeplessness in Shakespeare and Othello as well.
Mm-hmm.
And elsewhere in the canon. It's interesting to me, looking at the progression of villains and what it took Shakespeare to build to the point in his art where he could manage a tragedy with a hero villain that was as dark as the Macbeths. And, you know, when we first see him experimenting with Machiavels and with very villainous characters, you know, you're talking about Aaron Moore, you're talking about Richard III, you know, emerging in Henry VI III and sort of stepping forth as maybe the first great personality that Shakespeare invented. And they were very much in the Marlowian mold, you know. They were very similar to the Jew of Malta up to a point. But he started to insert their humanity at the end. You know, Aaron begins to be humanized a little bit when he has, you know, his child, his son. You know, Richard becomes haunted, you know, in his tent, you know, before is it Tewkesbury? Why do I want to say
everything? You're talking Richard III.
Yeah.
I can't help you.
The final battle. But anyway, he's, you know, he has his visitations of spirit, and finally, you know, is there a murderer there? No, yes, I am. Like, his doubt breaks forth and his guilt breaks forth. And as, you know, Shakespeare evolves and he stops explicating and we start to get into these characters like Iago, like, you know, Edgar, or I'm sorry, Edmund, who are in their way unfathomable. You know, I think it's fascinating that he loops back around to Macbeth and chooses to make him human from the beginning and explore the way his deeds and the things that he perceives himself as being forced to do tear him down.
Right.
Instead of showing him gleefully doing these things like Richard did, you know, joking about it and seducing the audience and exalting in what he's doing and his villainy and then seeing the cost later. It's so much more painful, you know, to watch this man with, and we're introduced to the way he's set up. You know, courage that's expressed in him,
Nobility. He's next. He's the next obvious choice to be king of Scotland. It's not going to be Prince of Cumberland going to Malcolm. Yeah. It's going to be Macbeth.
He just saved the sovereignty
of Scotland.
Yeah,
and I love that. It feels like George Washington to me. There was no question George Washington was going to be the first president of this country. There was it was unanimous. And he could have been king if they hadn't been kind of fed up with that. Thank you, George.
Well, no, they asked him.
That's, you know,
They offered to make him king.
And I don't quite want that.
Turned it down.
Even Macbeth says that, you know, wait, hey, I just helped out the king. I did a great thing.
Yeah.
Right. Why would I kill the king now when things are looking pretty good anyway?
Everything's okay. Thane Cawdor sounds pretty good right now. Yeah. Do I really want the next step?
Yeah. And maybe which will be given to me anyway. You know, I mean, there's just... it's like, this thing may happen, but how are you going to approach it?
But as they both get more and more tired.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Well, more and more, you know, beginning with that first, you know, I love the laugh that you get on 'Twas a Rough Night. when that opportunity gets missed, I'm like, oh, you're sitting on gold. But that first rough night and those hurried, you know, whispered exchanges in the dark and the panic.
Yeah,
it just evolves into these touchstones, and I do feel that's so important, Rob, and so present in your performance, that tiredness.
Well, all the way up until the end, I think his final moment, one, because he's been told he's going to be killed by someone not born of
a woman.
And just the tired, when you throw your sword to the side, you're just like, all right, I'm my own undoing right now. I believe fully in everything that's happened, that I've made happen, that's been told to me is going to happen. This is going to happen too, and I'm tired. I'm done. Might as well just get it over with, man. Mm-hmm.
How do you as an actor work with that sort of notion of extreme fatigue?
Well, when it's in the text, it helps. So when you're able to say, you know, these nightmares that we have, you know, we will eat our meal in fear and sleep in the affliction of these terrible dreams that shake us nightly. Better be with the dead, whom we to gain our piece of centerpiece. Than on the torture of the mind to lie in restless ecstasy. The idea that then, you know, come, we'll to sleep at the end of the banquet. And Jessica was brilliant in giving a direction in that moment of when she says, come, after the banquet's not gone so well, and everyone's gotten sent home, and the meat is cold, and, you know, it was really freaky, because the king saw things.
You did choose empty chair.
Mm-hmm. I did.
Which I think is the appropriate.
I love it, because otherwise we have a guy dressed up like a Halloween character, and it's never really scary to me. If they can find me a Banquo on stage that's really scary again, I'm in. But I think you have to do that cinematically. I don't know if you can do that in the theater.
Well, she says, this is the air-drawn dagger that you said drew you to Duncan. And
well, if you don't see the dagger, maybe we shouldn't see Banquo.
Exactly. Yeah.
But at the end of that, come, we'll to sleep. And Jessica gave me this beautiful nugget of gold to say, I think you should laugh when she says that. Because you've been trying for so long to sleep. Come, we'll to sleep. Yes, that's great. We'll go to sleep. My strange and self-abuse is the initiate fear that wants hard use. And that leads you right into the second act when I've lived long enough, I've supped full with horrors, my way of life has fallen into the seer.
Again to be aweary of the sun.
Again to be aweary of the sun.
World we're now undone.
And of course, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow.
That scene at the end of where you place the act break at the end of the banquet between the two of them at this empty banquet hall. Is just the most defeated. I mean, other than the actual moment of the tomorrow speech, is just the most incredibly beaten down moment. It's always so powerful to me, that scene. And Jessica, you chose to end it and to end the act on the image of Lady Macbeth seeing the imaginary spot of blood on her hand and starting to dab at it, which was just a stunning choice.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'd love to take credit for it. It was suggested to somebody, had an idea, and I was like, oh, I have to try that. You know? And my Lady M's were totally game.
Yeah.
And it just seemed
awesome. It made that leap. A lot of times people don't cover that leap.
Yeah.
Lady Macbeth. Like,
now she's sleepwalking.
Yeah.
Well, Knots had all spent when our desire is got without content. I mean, you know, this really, I mean, it's so interesting because you made this masterful, if I may say, pricey about the ways in which people choose to attack the play. You know, you said either a morality play or a this or a that. And I actually think this production does all three. Because to me, it is a morality tale. If ever you wanted to see why it's bad to kill people, I mean, you know, all you have to do is watch those consequences unroll. Despite their best attempts to actually have a moment of reveling and being king and queen, they get no time at all to do that. And they are so aware of how much pain they're in and how difficult their lives are. There is absolute, I mean, this is why I don't understand why people object to the idea that they were human beings, not just evil incarnate. Because if you just want to see how wrong it is to kill people, you have just to watch this play and see what happens to these poor saps who made this idiotic choice to kill a king, you know? Because there is nothing but bad for them that derives from it. And along the way, they take many people down. They've earned the things that people say about them in the outer world. But watching their inner psyche and the consequences that unroll for them, you know, Lady M prayed to be unsexed and devoid of, you know, unsex me here and fill me from the crown to the toe top full of direst cruelty.
Yeah.
And it only lasted for a little while, and that's the problem, you know? Interestingly, she was not able to sustain that, which is, I think, why...
Yeah, she wasn't able to stab him herself. She was at least tipsy. You know, that which hath made them drunk hath made me bold.
Yeah. And
she, they built to it.
And not only that, in the last line she says in the sleep, practically the last line she says in the sleepwalking scene is, what's done cannot be undone. And there is absolutely, you know, that I...
The choice to put the hand on the stomach.
That was a discovery of Anne's...
Wow.
I think it was Anne's. It was a discovery of one of them, Anne or Tessa's.
Anne or Tessa.
Yeah. Can't remember who found it
just
first.
To describe for the listener, because people can be like, what? In her dream was clearly shifting, which was interesting in and of itself, and she began to pull the doctor and the handmaiden into the dream and sort of assign them figures.
Yeah.
And took the handmaiden's hand and placed it on her stomach, you know, as you would to feel a child kick.
Yeah, she says, come, give me your hand.
Yes.
And then there's this expression of ecstasy as you can see her feel the child in her stomach kick. And that's just such a glorious thing. I mean, both Anne and Tessa discovered so many amazing things about that scene. We really did talk about the idea that the dream was this sort of smooth flowing in the way in which dreams just change things, you know, smoothly, but that sort of beautiful, there was so much beautiful discovery on the part of the women in terms of what they found.
And I watch that sleepwalking scene every night. Every night I'm in the bottom of the theater watching either Anne or Tessa do it, partly because it probably helps me get to the next scene myself, mostly because I just think it's such an innovative way to do the sleepwalking. It's such an iconic scene to see it discovered in a new way. Come, give me your hand, as in not my fane. Come, let's go wash our hands. It's come, give me your hand, feel our child kick. Come on. I mean, that's the life of it all, I think, there.
And so registers their humanity again.
Absolutely.
At such a late point in the play, when I would pretty much think it impossible, you know, it brings back the tragic component of that character.
Well, I will say that is the beauty of sharing the story you're telling with a group of incredibly smart actors and then seeing what they discover. I mean, I can't remember. I think it might have been Kimiko, but it could have been Kitty. I can't remember whose idea it was that Hecate was pregnant. And the idea, so then my little spirit sea sits in a foggy cloud and stays for me. You know, sort of once this idea was shared with a company of smart players, you know, this was a very much a mutual discovery about the pieces of storytelling that supported the whole journey, you know, and that was one of the biggest thrills of all.
And the really fun thing is that you get to work with two of each.
Indeed.
Yeah, so you can double up your discovery as you
and,
go along.
And there is no question that they each cross-pollinated, I think, and taught each other brilliant things, you know.
I think Bo put it once that he said, we had the experience of working on him together, working on Macbeth together, that we felt like each time we'd watch each other do a run, we were building our performance on each other's backs. Literally, I think that was his turn of phrase with it. That's what it felt like, because every time, maybe not that, but I love that. And so you show each other and show each other. It's the most collaborative thing I'd ever thought could be part.
Can you speak a little bit to that just as an ethic? Because you do this for every full production, right?
We do.
You have two casts.
Antaeus does this. It's the crazy thing that Antaeus does. I can speak of it. I'm sure Jessica can speak of it too, because I think it's the most challenging thing for the directors who work with us. I'd often thought, okay, this double casting thing, I like to call it partner casting, because double just sounds like you're halving it. It's partner casting, and the idea, I mean, I think it was started, was that we don't want to have to cancel shows when people get work that can sustain their bills, greater remunerative work in television
Simple,
or film.
Simple, brilliant idea.
Well, why not double it? But I thought for the longest time, after going to The Matrix for the first time, I guess Joe Stern started it years ago, and I used to look at the pictures, and I thought, that's ridiculous. They've got two people in the pink dress and two guys over in the tuxedo. It just looks, wow, this photo, why would they double cast? So I poo-pooed it without knowing it for the longest time, thinking, that makes no sense. If it's such a great idea, why isn't everybody doing it? And then I got to Antaeus, and I worked at a number of companies in town, but this company has actors that work more than... They'd have to pull out of shows more often than other companies. And then I got involved in Peace in Our Time, working with Casey Stengel last fall, got to build a role with another actor, Jason Heng, and we had a great time creating this character together, and it became the most egoless process. You have to check your ego at the door and say, I'm going to build this with somebody else, and figure out how to make that work. And then getting to do it with Bo was just, you know, that's icing on the cake. It was fantastic. So I'm a big proponent, not for all companies, but I'm thrilled to be in a company that is able to do it and explore a creative process in that way. As I said, for the director, Jessica basically directed two shows in the time that we should have to direct one. And that's a feat that would send most people into a home, or at least some people into
which
at least,
is where I'm residing now.
She's checking herself in for a little while, at least for rest, just bed rest. That's all we're working on. But it's I can only imagine the challenge, because you literally have two casts in for all the scenes, and people tag out, and the casts aren't chosen until just before tech by our. Hopefully our director does that work.
And that's fascinating.
Then the casts are split.
So, and
then a recent development over the only last few years, there used to be two casts, and then people would switch in when someone got a job on NCIS Tulsa. So all of a sudden they're having to go out, and we'll have the other cast come in. Well, what we started doing about a year and a half ago, I think, was to do some mixed casts.
Mm-hmm.
We put them all in a spinner, and we shoot out the casts for two nights a week. So sometimes you show up at the theater and say, oh, you're on tonight, I haven't done the show with you in 2 weeks. Great. And who's my banquo? And it's a fantastically fulfilling creative thing, certainly keeps you on your toes. But what was it like to direct it, Jessica?
it had its rewards and its challenges.
You are doing two shows. Two shows in some ways.
It's not.
You?
I mean, I would just say that it requires three times as much effort to get sometimes half as much done, frankly, just because what became very clear in the first day of blocking is that I mean, there are perhaps some directors who say, now on this line you'll cross to the left, take three steps, pick up the glass, and then. You know, that's actually not me at all. And so I work off actor impulses. And so
you have double the impulses.
Yeah. It became incredibly clear to me that on the very first day of blocking, that actually one person's impulse made no sense to another person. And so it couldn't just be that the first people who got up built the blocking and then the next people fit in. So in fact, you had to let both people get up and then somehow amalgamate the blocking.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a little crazy. And where possible, because I fall in love with an actor's choices. And so I both love the fact that the actors cross-pollinated, but I also didn't want to force one actor into doing what another actor did if they absolutely couldn't, where I could help it. Sometimes I couldn't help it. There's no question that there are a couple of choices that I think some actors love more than others, but they all must do it because it's not even like now that they're divided into two casts, they're always going to play together. They're going to constantly play with other people, so there are certain things where the blocking must be the same. Mm-hmm. But Bo and Rob actually do very different things in the banquet scene. And all the actors in the banquet scene know that when it's Rob, they get up here. When it's Bo, they get up here. And, you know, where and Joe, for instance, both the Banquos have very different takes on how they deal with their sons. Ramon is a much more sort of demonstrative, affectionate Banquo, and Joe Holt is much more soldierly in his approach. And they both love their sons. But Ramon does a kind of fun struggle, and he there's a line that Joe cuts that Ramon keeps, which is, here, take thee that too. Mm-hmm. He says, take my sword, and then he says, take thee that too.
And
he kisses him. Joe doesn't do that, because Joe's like, it's too squishy for me. you know, and I said, well, Joe, the thing that's important to me in this moment is I understand how much Banquo loves Fleance. So you do that how you need to. And so they do it differently. You know, it depends on what show you see, what you're going to see, depending on who's playing it. And the kids know that when they have this dad, they'll do it that way. And when they have that dad, they'll do it that way. And, you know, so where I was able to allow... I mean, Tessa and Anne do somewhat different things in the sleepwalking scene. And they're both incredibly beautiful and amazing. And, you know, where it doesn't need to be the same, I tried to let it be individual. But all that takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
At least two shows for the price of one Jessica Kubzansky. That's what we got. And when you put the hurly-burly of the mixed cast in, we have seven or eight different shows.
Yeah, the most traumatic thing was just dumb things like tacking the transition into the banquet scene, frankly. Because at a certain point, actors started not to be available, and so, you know, there's someone who's never done it in the dark, and it kind of doesn't matter how many times someone, your partner, describes to you how you fit the little hooks in the table, unless you're in the dark with it, you know? So that's
I'm just glad I'm backstage running lines at that point.
Really pragmatic.
What I have to say.
Yeah.
You know your own degrees. Okay, good, fine.
Well, we're coming to the end of our time together, and I want to ask you just what our listeners and what we can expect to see coming up from Antaeus and also from Boston Court, if you've got any other pots in the fire that you're able to share with us.
We have just mostly completed the casting of Kaufman and Hearts You Can't Take It With You, which will be our third production of the year.
Wonderful.
We figured Chekhov's The Seagull, Shakespeare's Macbeth, what's the obvious follow-up? You Can't Take It With You. Gigi Birmingham is directing that. We've been going through production minis of that, so that'll be opening. I should know the date, but I don't know anything other than my Macbeth lines this evening for this show. It's since, let's say this fall. Coming to you this fall, I believe we open in October.
What's the website address?
Antaeus.org, Antaeus.org, or Google the Titan that Hercules slew. That's Antaeus. I didn't know before I got here. That's what we have coming up next, and as well as our third act of Classics Fest, where we'll do six lightly staged readings of some works as we keep exploring. And there's
Wonderful.
Always something going on.
And I
here.
Believe we're going to try and sit down and have a conversation with some members of your A2.
Oh, great!
Ensemble.
Yeah,
great.
They've been in touch with us since we're going.
They're
back
doing.
Before.
They they're hopefully doing another show this fall as well. We have so many ideas of things to do and so little space. So we try to juggle as much as we can. But I'm glad you'll be talking to them. The A2 Ensemble is we need them as much as we need this building to do what we do.
Yeah, this place is exciting and always hopping with lots of really wonderful actors. It's a really fun place to hang out in, there's always something thrilling happening.
You know, it's so. Another really fun place to hang out? The theater at Boston Court. Have you been there? It's in Pasadena. It's on Mentor at Boston Court. What, you
well,
know
thank
it pretty
you,
well.
Rob.
What are you doing next?
thank you so much for the plug.
No, that was just a really, really blatant segue.
Yeah, I like it. The theater at Boston Court is just about to close our Oded Gross's adaptation of The Government Inspector, which was a co-pro with the Furious Theater Company. And we are actually starting rehearsal on Tuesday for this incredibly beautiful world premiere by Kate Wallach called Creation, which is a really stunning and exciting new play.
Wonderful.
So, yeah, it's very exciting. And if you're interested in finding out more about that, you can always go visit our website at bostoncourt.com or .org.
Now, who is directing Creation?
Creation is being directed by my co-artistic director, Michael McKetty.
I like Michael McKetty.
I do, too.
What are you directing next? Or do you know?
If you mean at Boston Court, we are in the middle of our next season's planning, and it is not yet announced in terms of Boston Court. So,
do you know what your next job is?
Yes, I do know what several of my next jobs are.
Good. I'm
yes,
glad you got them lined up.
Thank you very much. Yes, I do. Yes, I will actually... later in the fall go to Portland Center Stage and do a really fun play by James Still about James Beard called I Love to Eat. So I too from Macbeth will go to something very important like the culinary arts.
That's true. Rob, Jessica, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and talk with us. It's been so much fun.
It's actually
your
thoughts.
Really
awesome conversation.
What a pleasure. I forgot there was a microphone. That was really nice. Thank
you. Yeah,
thank you so much.
It's such a joy to actually get to talk about the deliciousness of Shakespeare with people who also know and revere it. So thanks for the opportunity.
Well, thanks for putting on a wonderful production and congratulations again.
Yeah.
And, you know, Rob, break a leg tonight. Hopefully
Thank you.
You're going to get through this thing without anything you'll have to later blame on the curse.
Knock on wood. Yes, I should be okay. Yeah, we all hit wood right there.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? We all respect the curse. We like that.
I did like the director's note, or the little bit in the program.
Oh, that's not mine, actually. That was an Antaeus. Yeah, that's a...
Just addressing the curse.
Yeah,
and like,
absolutely.
Listen... Things go wrong, selective memory, there's no curse. All right. For myself, Jonathan Redding, my co-host.
Philip Kelly.
This has been Advice.
To the players.
To the players.
Terrific.